I'll start out with this little biographical anecdote. Namely, my background was, I was never a terribly good theoretical particle physicist, but my background was in theoretical particle physics as my PhD, and I rather like this cartoon a friend of mine found on the web about how particle physicists do biology. And I think it has some serious points to make about changing disciplines and the nature of science, and particularly the nature of applied mathematics, when one moves from particularly a discipline like physics, where models are describing rather simpler systems than they are in biology, and are more, therefore, a more precise representation of the exact system than there are in biology itself. But my later motivation, I came into mathematical modelling all of biological systems almost by chance after doing my PhD in string theory, and partly I recognised I was better at more applied mathematics and simpler mathematics than I was in the sort of mathematics involved in string theory, but also partly I had been motivated by, I mean, the death of a brother of a friend of mine from HIV to start finding out about epidemic modelling and about the fact that you could actually potentially make a difference. And I just go back to the motivation, which certainly is the motivation of most people working in an Imperial College group, of why they undertake modelling. There are, of course, many other motivations, scientific interests and the like, interest in dynamics. But Daniel Bernoulli, looking at the mortality burden of smallpox and the potential benefits of immunisation, which was in its earliest stages of development in the 18th century, said, "I simply wish that in a matter which so closely concerns the well-being of mankind, no decision shall be made without all the knowledge which a little analysis and calculation can provide." Daniel Bernoulli, of course, is much better known for really striking contributions to other areas of mathematics, but it's notable that one of his earliest applied works was in this area. So just to introduce this lecture series, today I'm going to actually talk about, we'll give a personal tour of what I think are the relevant areas of mathematics and model development as applied to outbreaks. I won't focus on the use of epidemic models for outbreak control in this lecture. That'll be more in lecture two, where I focus on the particular public health role of modelling, and there, of course, modelling interventions is particularly important. Lecture three is my one sop to the theme of this this programme, namely some work I've done on the modelling of antiviral resistance in an influenza pandemic. To drill down into this lecture a little more detail, the overall focus I'm going to try and convey to you is the indivisibility of models and data, really, and how data should drive models. And so I'll start from the idea of what do we know about epidemics, how do we perceive epidemics, to talk about the epidemic as a branching process and how far you can get in analysing epidemic dynamics when viewed in that way mathematically, before extending that, moving away from a simple branching process description to starting to model a susceptible population, and then going from the range of spending a little bit of time on the simple SIR model, where I still think there are some interesting things to draw out from that simplest Kermack-McKendrick model, to looking at the trends which are pushing models to ever greater degrees of complexity, and how we can use the data which is now being collected from infectious disease outbreaks to help validate such models and justify that complexity. And I'll highlight a particularly nice example collaboration between my group, particularly Simon Kauschmes in my group, and CDC in Atlanta, some data collected last year in that regard. And I'll finish off, if I have time, just with a personal view of some outstanding issues in this area. And I should say, overall, this whole series of lectures are going to be focusing on outbreaks, namely closed epidemic models, where you can ignore population, births, and deaths, so acute infectious disease outbreaks. I actually work on many endemic diseases as well, but I think keeping this focus gives at least makes my tasks more achievable than giving a broader review. But this is a slide I give most commonly to clinicians, public health policymakers, to try and give a sense of what modelling is about. And really, I think the term knowledge synthesis, pulling together our understanding and data information on different aspects of infectious disease dynamics, ecology, and drawing out certain key conclusions from that. And the data shown in blue on the left-hand side here, I'll use this pointer here, on the natural history, evolution, demography, epidemiology, and then trying to get insight into the fundamental mechanisms driving epidemics, fundamental parameters, and then if one attempts it, one wants to attempt to do so, some idea of predictions of trends. That might not be a formal numerical prediction, it might be some sort of more qualitative prediction, and then control policy planning. And I put another axis down that right-hand side of this slide, that generally, historically at least, at the top, we've talked about rather simple models going into that, giving that basic insight, analytical insight particularly, and as we move down to trying to inform detailed control policy planning and informing public health policy directly, we tend to move to rather more complex models. That's also an analogy for my lecture, because whilst I will go into some considerable detail about simple models, the talk will get ever more vague when I talk about model complexities, just in the interest of time. So let's start at the beginning, the epidemic as a branching process, and why am I viewing it in this way? Well, let's think about how we view epidemics. In this slide I gave in a talk to the International Conference for Emerging Infectious Diseases a few weeks ago in Atlanta, and it's how a lot of public health clinicians and the population at large will view an epidemic. They view epidemics as diseases affecting individuals, and the characteristic they're interested in is actually the mortality and morbidity caused by epidemics, here represented from Ebola virus, H5N1, the plague, and SARS in 1918, influenza, and of course HIV in the middle. Epidemics kill people, and they're unique. They're unlike chronic infectious diseases in the sense that they spread from person to person. Another view we might have in epidemics is at the population rather than individual level, it is the epidemic curve as such. And we might go back to the Spanish flu pandemic on the left-hand side there, mortality data, and this data from 1918 is still proving invaluable today. Just because so many people did die, we actually have quite a good resolution of the trajectory of the epidemic in different communities, from which we can derive characteristics of the transmission dynamics of that particular epidemic. But we have many other examples. I show SARS in Hong Kong, 2003, and increasingly, of course, we have geographically resolved data arriving in real time, as typified by the data we had available last year for the H1N1 swine flu pandemic. The sort of things we might want to get at, as compared with mortality and morbidity on the previous slide, from this sort of data is things on the doubling time of the epidemic, the so-called attack rate, otherwise called the final size of the epidemic. How can we connect individuals and populations? Well, the connection is, of course, understanding the contact process, which links individuals together to give rise to large-scale outbreaks. And I represent that here with actual data, contact tracing data from three example outbreaks. One was one of the last smallpox outbreaks in 1966 in the UK, where detailed contact tracing data was collected. Another SARS in Singapore, other detailed contact tracing data, and then a rather more partial view of what was happening in the earlier stages of the swine flu epidemic in the UK. In each case, of course, these outbreaks look like trees. They're a classic branching process. One thing to note is, of course, that there's the offspring distribution, the number of secondary cases per case as you go through the tree, is highly variable and rather over-dispersed in all of these examples, and I'll come back to that there. How can we characterize this branching process? Well, of course, the secondary attack rate of the offspring distribution is one way. The reproduction number or the moments of the offspring distribution are the other things we typically are interested in, and we want to embed this in chronological time, so we're interested in the so-called generation time, the time between rounds of infection. And that brings us to that time representation of an epidemic, and a rather more simplified version of that simple branching process, where one infected individual generate two more, giving geometric growth. Well, of course, reality is a little more complex than that, but still on average we see exponential growth of an epidemic characterized by the mean of the offspring distribution at each generation, the so-called reproduction number, which at the start of the epidemic, if no one is immune, is called the basic reproduction number. And simple results in branching process theory tell you that clearly this is a threshold-like quantity. It needs to be greater than one for a large outbreak to have a finite probability of occurring, at least in a large population. So I'll go into a little more detail in the mathematics, but let's now step back and take the viewpoint of somebody involved in public health and looking at an emerging outbreak, looking at some of those data as they're collected. How might we analyse such data? Well, traditionally, epidemiologists have calculated things like the doubling time of an epidemic, like the secondary attack rate in particular groups and households, for instance. But if we wanted to get insight into the actual branching process itself, then first of all, the thing to realise is we don't need to model a susceptible population. We can just look at the cases emerging, even in the absence, as I'll show you in a moment, of contact tracing data. Analyses of a variety of past epidemics show the potential of doing this all the way actually back to the BSE epidemic in 1999. I'm sure there are early examples as well, but we did it, as other groups did, in the foot and mouth disease outbreak in 2001, where you can calculate, using the sort of methods I'll outline in a minute, how the reproduction number of an epidemic changes through time, shown in that graph on the right-hand side. Actually, that's some steps down the road of actually how you analyse real outbreak data. Something I won't go into much detail on in this talk in the interest of time is that there's an initial set of data cleansing, of correcting for right censoring, which is key. How do you correct the incidence data you get for the reporting delays inherent in any surveillance system? But assuming you do have accurate incidence data, then we can use the theory of branching processes to estimate things about the offspring distribution, particularly the reproduction number, given knowledge of things like the generation time. And the basic approach is really quite simple, and I'll have a few slides of mathematics, given this is the Fields Institute. I don't normally put mathematics in my talks, but I've decided to today. Let's consider a set of cases. Imagine we have an outbreak observed up to a certain time. We have M cases. And here I'll talk about when we have very detailed data in individual cases. And we label those cases with a disease onset time, when somebody becomes symptomatic. Then we assume we have some information. We might actually derive this from the same data, but let's assume we have some independent information on the incubation period distribution, the time from being infected, and disease onset. How infectious somebody is at a time tau after they're infected, F of tau, and a set of what I'll call transmission risk covariates, a set of kind of vector valued quantities for each individual which determine maybe things like age group, spatial location, and something which tells you if two individuals, I and J, have different risk covariates, XI, XJ, HXI, XJ tells you what the relative risk of transmission from I to J is. The simplest assumption is just assuming this is 1, you model homogeneous mixing, but you can make that more complex. Now, one can just define very simply the probability that I infects J in this way. You have some absolute transmission risk phi J. I'll come back to this, but you'll see in the next equation it cancels. And then you have an integral over the two incubation period distributions of I and J, and the thing which links those two and tells you the probability that at a particular time I infected J is this infectiousness profile F. And then at the end, you're multiplying by this kernel function of the covariates. Now, this is all, I mean, for those of you who've seen the Vallinger and Tunis type approach to estimating reproduction numbers in real time, this is just a slight elaboration of that, really. You can then calculate, conditional on I being infected, on J being infected, what's the probability I infected J, Rij, and it's just simply the normalized version of that, Qij divided by sum over all I of Qkj. And you'll notice this is where I've left this out, because the phi J's cancel in that expression, and that means you have quite a simple expression. If you know what the infectiousness profile incubation period distribution is, and something about the risk kernel, then you can calculate this quantity, probability that I infects J, just on the basis of knowledge about the onset times. And if you just want to calculate the total number of secondary cases caused by Ksi, then it's just sum over J of that Rij. Now, there's some approximations in this. First of all, in a real epidemic, the tau j's, the incubation periods, are not actually independent random variables, because what you actually see realized in terms of incubation periods will depend on the actual trajectory of the epidemic. However, that in most cases can be ignored. The other thing which is ignored here is that I've assumed this phi j, the absolute risk of transmission, 2j, it's a sort of beta type quantity, to appear on the next slide, is something which is characteristic of the individual j rather than having any time dependence. And that, of course, is rarely the case. Typically, if there are interventions or other things going on in the epidemic, phi j will vary over time. And by assuming it's time independent, you're making an approximation. What these methods have been used for, simpler versions of these methods quite often, have been taking detailed data on the incidence of cases, perhaps supplemented with contact tracing data, and it's sort of easy to see how, if you actually had prior information on the probability of I infecting J, that can be naturally put into this inference framework. Together with data on the generation time distribution, that is what informs the F of tau, the infectiousness as a function of tau, time, you can start estimating things about what is the mean reproduction number through time, or what is the what is the distribution of the offspring distribution itself. Stepping up one, in most cases you don't actually have very detailed data on individual cases. Stepping up one level, you might have aggregate data, which gives you case incidence through time, here represented by I of t. And again, and this is just another form in some sense of the branching process, though here I'm doing a deterministic representation of that. But again, I'm not modeling, and the important thing here is I'm not representing the susceptible population in any way. And I'm using a nice, most of this work is actually really quite old, but Christoph Fraser did a nice summary of it in FOSS 1 a couple of years ago. I start with a renewal equation at the top for the incidence of infectives, and of course, the incidence of infectives at time t can be calculated as an integral over time of the incidence of infectives in the past, weighted by an infectiousness function, which depends on time, chronological time itself, and time passed since somebody was infected. And from that simple quantity, that simple renewal equation, you can calculate two simple reproduction numbers. One is the case reproduction number, which is the for somebody infected at time t, the number of cases they will generate on average at that time in the epidemic. And you'll see it's integral over beta t plus tau. Compare that with the instantaneous reproduction number. The only difference between the two is in that case, you're calculating the number of cases that an individual infected at time t would generate if all things stay the same. So in the beta t tau, you no longer have the t plus tau. It's an important distinction because in one case, you only need information on the value of beta t tau at time t to calculate that estimate, and otherwise you need information going into the future. Typically what's done though is this transmission kernel is factorized into a time-dependent component. I've represented phi t here, you could call it beta t, and that f of tau, the infectiousness profile through time, or the generation time distribution you can call it, which I used on the previous slide. If f of tau is normalized so the integral is 1, then the instantaneous reproduction number now is just exactly the same as phi of t. And you can vary inserting into these equations very quickly, calculate really quite simple expressions for the reproduction number as at a particular point in time. The instantaneous one here, rather simpler, just incidence at time and then this back convolution of the incidence of time with the generation time distribution, or you can calculate a slightly more complicated case reproduction number. The nice thing is this, in a discrete time representation, coming back to the incidence data we might have, with knowledge of the generation time distribution and data on disease incidence or infection incidence, you can readily then have estimates of the reproduction number through time that way. This is the instantaneous one. This is actually the one that Valling and Tinnis came up with, the case reproduction number. I won't go further into the relationship between the two. And so these are clearly analytically easy expressions to use, which make fairly minimal assumptions, are quite robust to a lot of variation in the underlying model. You can have any offspring distribution you like. You can indeed include heterogeneity and susceptibility or infectiousness, and they're still robust for estimating the mean reproduction number through time. Of course, you can simplify still further. If you assume all you know is a growth rate, an exponential growth rate, and you assume the epidemic is growing exponentially at the top there, then of course you come back to the classic expression for the reproduction number. Well, both of them are the same in that case, and you end up with 1 over the Laplace transform of the generation time distribution, again nicely reviewed by Bollinger and Lipsitch in a paper a few years ago. In the very special case of an exponentially distributed generation time distribution of the type you have in simple compartmental models, you get the classic expression for the relationship between the reproduction number and the real-time growth rate and the generation time. I have to say, one of the reasons I've gone through this is just to highlight that the underlying mathematics, which goes into what a lot of people tend to apply implicitly if they're just fitting an SIR model to epidemic data, this is only accurate in a very limited subset of cases. In fact, I would argue it's almost never really an accurate approximation to real infectious disease outbreaks, because rarely are generation time distributions even vaguely resembling exponential. And most of the errors we see in the literature in estimates of the reproduction number for a wide range of pathogens are frankly due to carelessness about assumptions about the generation time distribution, and really not taking account of this prior literature on branching process theory and the real relationship between generation time distributions and real-time growth rates in epidemics. Instead, just blindly, for instance, fitting an SIR model to some incidence data. Many examples of this. The earliest one I could find of my own work, actually, where we used the form of, actually quite an elaborate form of the renewal equation, because you have to correct for survivorship because of the timescale of the epidemic, was the mad cow disease, BSE epidemic in UK cattle, the first outbreak I actually worked on, where we published an estimate of the reproduction number through time of that outbreak. The most effective intervention measures were introduced in about 1988, 1989, as you can see from the profile there. I've already mentioned SARS and the foot and mouth disease outbreak, and then a whole variety of groups used variants on these methods to generate estimates of the reproduction number in different settings around the world for the swine flu epidemic last year. And these are our estimates very early on from the data collected in Mexico, all of which centered around about a reproduction number of about 1.5. So I hope I've shown that these branching process methods, because they make very few assumptions, they make no assumptions about the susceptible population, and are really quite robust to additional heterogeneity in the models, and implicit model of the transmission process, are robust and therefore can give quite useful insight into at least the rate of spread of a disease, the generation of the reproduction number. I haven't had time to go into how you actually estimate the generation time, but of course if you actually have contact tracing data, prior data on who infected who during the earliest stages of an epidemic, that data can be used to generate simultaneously generation time distribution estimates and reproduction number estimates. There are a few problems with the approach. First of all, a slightly technical problem. In the case of a highly transmissible outbreak where you have a highly clustered contact network, for instance, house cells are very important, and the high transmission rate, the actual generation time distribution can differ from the idealized F of tau because of saturation of infection in those small groups, and that can bias one's estimate. The more fundamental shortcomings is these are really descriptions of what's happening rather than something which allow you to say why it's happening and therefore make predictions about the future or inferences about control measures. You can't really get any prior insight into the impact of interventions, and until you know something about how the susceptible population is being depleted through an epidemic, as an epidemic progresses, you really can't say anything useful about when an epidemic is likely to peak, what the final attack rate is likely to be. And so to do that, you need to go one stage further, of course, and start modeling, including in your description, something about the susceptible population. I've already really said why. I mean, we want to be able to predict the trajectory. We want a mechanistic understanding of the contact process as well as just a description of the branching process. The challenge is we need to make many, many more assumptions about the nature of the contact process as soon as we start modelling contacts between infected and susceptibles. And increasingly, for reasons I'll explain later, I mean, we're being driven to ever more complex models, partly as data becomes more available, but also because public health, if we want to use models for public health purposes, people expect to see them validated against real data and reproduce aspects of real epidemics which are difficult to capture with simpler models. And so in terms of model complexity, I mean, I'm talking in a mathematics institute, and as we know, our idea of mathematical simplicity is something where we'd like to have the state space as low dimensional as possible to allow analytical tractability. We can get some fundamental insight into the dynamics. A biostatistician, however, might have a rather different goal in terms of model complexity. Their principal goal might be to have a low dimensional parameter space so that it's feasible to estimate all parameters from available data. In reality, we need a balance. The state space requirement is actually diminishing as we get more and more powerful computers. It is possible to do fairly exhaustive large-scale simulations, though of course we are sacrificing something in terms of analytical insight. I think the biostatistician's requirement for a low-dimensional parameter space, though, is more fundamental. It is easy to build very complex simulations, which are frankly just toys to play with. I mean, it's impossible to validate all the assumptions going into them, and therefore, in my view at least, they have limited role in terms of making really informing public health decision making. The other desire and the other thing, pressure on model complexity, is of course what epidemiologists, public health specialists, clinicians, or those people who are expert in individual diseases want. If you are one of those people, then you've built your career on really understanding the details behind any one disease and how it spreads in a population or how it infects individual people, or for that matter, animals. And it is very hard then to have a modeler stand up and say, well, I've ignored all this and I'm just going to present results with a simple model. And modelers have partly responded by putting in additional complexity. Some of it justifiable, I think, in terms of representing natural history in a better way, that has real consequences for conclusions. In other cases, less justifiable. My own view is that really, fundamentally, complexity should be driven by what you're wanting the model to fundamentally do. And really, the skill in modeling is knowing what to leave out rather than what to put in. Of course, we know what we want to capture at a large scale. We want to capture the dynamics of an epidemic curve, the initial establishment of an epidemic, exponential growth, and then the exhaustion of susceptibles, and then perhaps what happens afterwards. How do we do that? Well, before I talk about how we do it in terms of choice of model complexity, let's just start at that beginning bit, establishment. And actually, this is a little non sequitur because really this is another extension of branching process theory. You don't need to model the susceptible population. But I think it's important in terms of showing how implicit assumptions in even very simple models have a big effect. The offspring distribution has, I've talked about the mean of the offspring distribution, the reproduction number, which is by far the most important a moment of that distribution, but the other moments have a significant impact, particularly in the earliest stages of an epidemic. And Jamie Lloyd-Smith's work published in Nature a few years ago nicely summarized this. But I mean, clearly in the mathematical literature, it's been known for much longer, less in the public health literature. If we have a probability generating function G of the offspring distribution, then I don't have time to go into how you demonstrate this, but you can demonstrate that the probability in an infinite population, if you're seeding with a single infected individual, the probability of getting a small, only a finite outbreak, is the solution of that equation that P is equal to G of P, where G is the probability generating function. For the simplest case, the geometric offspring distribution, what you get out of a simple SIR model with exponentially distributed waiting times, that means the probability of a small outbreak is just 1 over R naught, or more generally 1 over R naught to the power Y naught, where Y naught is the initial number of infectives in the population. For for a Poisson offspring distribution, which is what you get when you assume a completely fixed infectious period, same in every individual is the opposite extreme, then you get the solution, the representation of that equation at the top is just the same thing as you get for the final size distribution equation. And you can interpolate between the two using a negative binomial offspring distribution, which is what Jamie Lloyd Smith nicely did in his Nature paper, and then compared, tried to estimate the parameters of the negative binomial for a variety of diseases from data. But there's a huge difference between those two. In one case, the Poisson assumption, you get a much higher probability of a large outbreak, because there's much less variability between individuals for higher values of the reproduction number than for the geometric distribution, where the geometric distribution gives you a high degree of heterogeneity between individuals. Most individuals infect very few people. A small number of individuals infect a lot of people. If you're feeding with a single person, a single infected individual in an epidemic, that means that most such seeded outbreaks will go extinct, even up to very high levels of the reproduction number. And certainly if we're talking about levels in the range of, say, flu and SARS, between about here and 1.5 to 4, we're talking about substantial extinction probabilities. Of course, you could go for something even more extreme than geometric if you wished, and get even higher extinction probabilities. The other reason this is important, and it's is that it affects our interpretation of outbreak data, particularly in the cases, for instance, like when we're analysing outbreaks of clusters of human cases of H5N1 avian flu, or for instance, small outbreaks of diseases like SARS. That what we're seeing, of course, are the large outbreaks. Our surveillance systems are attuned to the larger outbreaks, and we don't necessarily see all the very small outbreaks which go extinct. And that means by analysing just the larger outbreaks, and particularly the first few generations infection in those outbreaks, we get biased estimates of things like the reproduction number, upwardly biased. We overestimate the reproduction number compared with if we analysed multiple disease outbreaks, including the ones which went extinct. After that slight non-sequitur, but I think it's important because it underpins the earlier stages of epidemics, the closed population SIR model. Well, I show the two easy representations of this. This is the classic Hermit-McKendrick model with exponential waiting times SIR. The deterministic representation will be the one most people are familiar with. People get infected at a mass action rate, beta SI over N, and then recover at rate nu. The generation time is 1 over nu, and the reproduction number is beta over nu. The forward equation is the stochastic representation of that model is given in the first equation by the forward equation, about which I will say relatively little in this talk. I mean, it gives the classic epidemic curve, but I just want to highlight the implicit assumptions in this. We are assuming unrealistically an exponentially distributed infectious period, and that gives rise to a geometric offspring distribution, which is at the far extreme of what you might assume about heterogeneity and infectiousness. Nevertheless, still it's readily analyzable, and some interesting results can be obtained. Well, I hope everybody in the audience recognizes the top equation, namely just the final size relationship for a closed epidemic model, transcendental equation. The second one might be less familiar, but actually in terms of the application of this model to emerging infectious disease outbreaks is as important, and I might argue more important than the final size relationship. It's namely, when does the epidemic peak? Here I've defined the epidemic peak as peak prevalence. You could define it as peak incidence equally. It's readily calculable. That is what the value of the prevalence is at peak. For these to be meaningful, let's actually represent them. Here, just looking at a range of values of the reproduction number suitable for influenza between about 1 and 2. This is the final size relationship, and this is the peak prevalence relationship. They're on different axes, of course. Final size goes rapidly up to close to the full population. Peak prevalence stays at a much lower level. Of course, peak incidence depends also on the generation time, and another reason for using peak prevalence here. What are the important characteristics of these curves? Well, one important aspect of it is, what does a change in the reproduction number do to the relative magnitude of these quantities. So by what percentage will, if I change the reproduction number by 1%, what percentage change will I see in either the final size or the peak prevalence? And this is what I'm plotting here. We see for the final size, we have this classic curve. Clearly, as you get close to the threshold value of 1, your control effort has a much bigger impact on final size. But the interesting thing is that you always have a much bigger impact on peak prevalence. Bear in mind, that's a log scale on that axis on the right-hand side than you do on the final size. So any intervention measure will have a bigger proportionate impact on the peak of an epidemic, the magnitude of the peak, than on the final size. Not something which has often been commented on in the literature, but actually it turns out to be a very, very robust result. It's true for nearly all network models. In fact, it's quite difficult to construct a model for which this isn't true, and it has consequences, because if we talk about something like an influenza pandemic, whilst we might, in terms of a severe pandemic, one of our goals might be to reduce overall mortality and morbidity, namely something related to the final size, a secondary goal will be to reduce peak healthcare demand, peak burden on healthcare services. And that's something much more closely related to the peak prevalence during an epidemic. And that's an easier goal to achieve than reducing the overall final size. I would actually argue the top bullet point here that final size is a fairly useless estimator of R. Despite everything in the mathematical literature about the use of final size relationships to estimate the reproduction number, I point out that, first of all, you only observe the final size at the end of an epidemic. It's often under-ascertained. We typically count cases, which are a fraction of all infections. And more importantly, that the real final size of an epidemic is always much smaller than that predicted by the simple homogeneous mixing SIR model. You always have heterogeneities which will substantially reduce the final size below what you assume by homogeneous mixing. And finally, using the final size, given the vagaries of data and the error, you can only really resolve R in the range of between 1 and 2, because if you go much above 2, then you're talking about final size which are really quite close to 1. So heterogeneity in transmission, I would say in general, doesn't necessarily affect the shape of these curves dramatically. There are some cases it can. Certainly doesn't affect the fact that this blue curve is above and a different shape from the red curve here, but can change dramatically the scaling factor you apply to those curves. The last thing, and just in a simple model, which is critically important, of course, is when does the epidemic peak? What is the timescale of the epidemic? Well, that's a harder thing to calculate analytically. The final size peak prevalence results could be calculated without reference to chronological time, but if you're you can of course numerically solve very easily for different generation times. That's what I do here for fixed reproduction number. As you increase the generation time, then the epidemic time scale is proportional to the generation time scale linearly with it. And that difference, of course, is the difference between, say, influenza and smallpox. It's why smallpox was readily controllable, where you have a long incubation period, lots of time to act between generations, implement intervention measures like contact tracing, whilst with influenza it's impossible. I'm sure this has been done before. I couldn't actually readily find analytical approximations to, I don't think it's calculable exactly, but analytical approximations to when, what's the exact time you get peak prevalence. But using a saddle point approximation, it's relatively easy to demonstrate that a second order approximation, which is actually very accurate up to reproduction numbers of about 5, is given by this. You have a clearly linear dependence of the reproduction number on the generation time divided by R0 minus 1, and then a term intuitively obvious. This is the exponential growth period of the epidemic from initial numbers infected I0 out of N, and then a term corresponding to the nonlinear part of the epidemic, which I've chosen to expand in powers of log of R0 minus 1. And this is actually accurate to within about 1% for R0 up to about 5. The nice thing also about this is, again, this relationship is again, more robust than the final size relationship to the introduction of heterogeneity in transmission. And it's a, I mean, the timing of epidemics, if you have a knowledge of the generation time, a knowledge of the reproduction number, are quite deterministically and robustly estimated. But of course, the simple epidemic model, tells you something about the expected dynamics, but doesn't allow you to decompose that complexity, and therefore itself makes it very difficult to say anything robust about, for instance, the impact of control measures. And that's where we want to include transmission heterogeneity and go beyond homogeneous mixing. We want to say, what are the quantities, the biological quantities, which determine the reproduction number, to do with pathogen biology, host factors, post-population structure? How do we build a model which incorporates those? To do that, I'm going to argue we really fundamentally need to base our models in data. And the sort of data I've already emphasized this, we want to use, for instance, data on natural history. We don't want to make arbitrary assumptions about exponentially distributed generation times, but let's actually gather data on incubation periods, and either data from contact tracing studies or maybe shedding of virus from infected people through time to estimate the generation time distribution. We want to incorporate some information on contact heterogeneity, and a dominant paradigm has been to represent this in terms of models of contact networks, and it's been very popular in the physics community and also in the social science community. I would argue it's a useful kind of theoretical construct, but it's actually rather hard to define in most cases, particularly if we talk about respiratory diseases. What is the contact network you're interested in? People sort of equate a fuzzily defined social network with being the contact network, but really doing that underestimates complexity. The strength of links, for instance, will vary dramatically depending whether you meet somebody occasionally socially or somebody is in your own household. I will argue that for reasons mostly based in the data but also in kind of epidemiology, at least the respiratory pathogens, it's much more useful to model explicitly particular social units such as the household, school, class, work group, because you can collect epidemiological data on those units and quantify transmission. And that's what my own and lots of other people's models have done. So-called models of multiple levels of mixing, where you model individuals mixing in households. That was the simplest multiple levels of mixing model. you have kind of household transmission and then community transmission, but you could layer on additional mixing places and workplaces, schools. You effectively have a bipartite graph of households to places in this representation. It's easy also to embed this representation, whilst you don't have to, but you can embed it in geographic space quite easily, because we have data on where people live and where people work and the distances they travel. And that makes construction of large-scale simulations of these processes, of the type I'll show in a second, much simpler. And this is exactly what I did several years ago. This is one of the simpler of such models, in the sense I only model household, schools, and workplaces, and then a more general community transmission, which is localized and parameterized from travel data. This is the emergence of a pandemic in Thailand in Southeast Asia. The grayscale is population density, and the red is infected. And of course, you can couple that to a model, and many people have done this now, of, say, international spread of a pathogen, and ask, how long would we expect a pandemic to take, an influenza pandemic, to peak in the source region, given a certain assumption about transmissibility, and then how quickly would it spread to a country like the UK, how quickly would it peak there? Of course, what I've stated in the bullet points here, which I won't go over, really are not so much results from modelling, they're what we've seen in past pandemics, which we want to represent in models, in pandemic models used for pandemic planning. Green, I should say, are areas where the epidemic is over, the susceptible population has built up, the immune population has built up. But of course, to parameterize such models, we want data. We want, if we've included things like households, workplaces, equivalent, you could say, we've included age structure in a compartmental formulation. We want data to justify the additional transmission parameters going into the model. The nice thing about things including household and school structure is you can get such data. We never directly observe transmission, or almost never, certainly not for respiratory pathogens, but we do have lots of data from household studies on secondary attack rates of respiratory diseases in the household setting. Additionally, we can collect lots of data clearly on the underlying demographic structure of populations, age structure, household size distributions. And now we're collecting, and this is from the Gerald Masson's paper with John Edmonds, published in PLOS Medicine a couple of years ago, the Polymod study, where they did a survey of a study population where they asked people to record contacts with people of different ages, how many contacts a day they made. We can get data on how frequently people of one age contact people of other ages. White is more intense contact, blue less intense. And here you see what you would expect to see, namely people tend to mix with people of their own age, children mix more intensely, and adults mix with their children, these off-diagonal elements. All of these things come together to allow you to parameterize models more realistically. And going up to a larger spatial scale, we can talk about travel data. How do we parameterize the embedding of those models in geographic space and the assumptions we make about the probability that somebody residing in one place is going to infect somebody residing in a different place? Well, we have increasingly detailed data, not just at the aggregate level on what is the distribution of travel distances somebody might make. And what you generally find there is some sort of truncated power law in such distributions. That most people only travel very short distances, but you have this long fat tail of people who make long distance journeys. But beyond that, with data available, say, from mobile phones, and this is a mapping of where some three individuals made mobile phone calls from on this kilometer scale, you get data on the heterogeneity of travel patterns between different individuals, which is, of course, great. Most people are quite local in their movement, but some people travel much further distances. And we can quantify it, we can fit models, such as gravity models, to such data. Finally, of course, we want data on interventions. And the reason we want this for two reasons. First of all, interventions that act as perturbations of the dynamics of systems and therefore give additional information on the underlying transmission parameters. Secondly, in many cases, public health interventions, by which I mean non-pharmaceutical interventions, quarantine, school closure, those sort of things, cannot be tested in randomized controlled trials, and so we have to rely on observation to infer their impact on transmission. I showed two simple examples here. I don't have time to go into the details. We analyzed data collected in 1918, the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic in different US cities, and fitted simple epidemic models to the very different patterns seen in different US cities and explained those differences on the basis of the very different control measures those cities used during the epidemic. And the US was fairly unique in introducing quite intensive control measures, particularly after the first few epidemics on the East Coast cities. A more contemporary example, the work of Simon Kauschmes and myself and colleagues in Paris on estimating the impact of school closure on seasonal influenza transmission, where you have time series data on influenza incidents, you have the timing shown in pink of school holidays in different regions, and through quite sophisticated time series analysis, you try to ask how much impact does the school holiday have on influenza incidents in different age groups. That actually also gives you insight into the basic transmission parameters of influenza in schools, which we didn't have before. I'm going to skip over that. Just to sum some of this up, I mean, with really a state-of-the-art data set collected last year by colleagues in CDC, this next few slides just show you what we can do today with detailed outbreak data. So early in, I think it was April or May 2009, there was an outbreak of H1N1 in a small community in Pennsylvania. School-based outbreak, but colleagues, collaborators of ours at CDC in Atlanta collected incredibly detailed data, both on the individual cases who were affected in the school, but also the cases in the households of those people infected in the school. So we have a very detailed epidemic curve broken down by the grade of children and which class indeed they were in, whether they were boys or girls. Additionally, they collected data on what were seating charts in the school, where people sat in different classrooms, on the social networks in school, who people mixed with, friends, and I particularly segregate by age there. Of course, you always get that one boy who mostly has friends who are girls, but generally there's a fair degree of segregation. And indeed, they have some activities which might have been related to perhaps super spreading events. seeing in particular a cow eyeball was passed around one particular classroom. Incredibly detailed data, very rarely collected at this level. And Simon was able then to fit a full maximum likelihood model of the transmission process, which incorporated the heterogeneity, classes, grades, school heterogeneity, and then the household coupled to that. I don't have time to go into the details of the model, but you get the general sense of it. Some real challenges in the inference. You, of course, have missing data. You don't directly observe infections, and so you have to impute the infection dates, augment the data in a classic reversible jump MCMC approach. But the nice thing coming out of this is you get remarkable insight into the transmission process. First of all, uniquely, now we have detailed information on the transmission risk, not just comparing households with schools, but comparing the same class in a school with the same grade in a school, and the school overall, you see that hierarchy. People in the same class are much more likely to transmit to other people in the same class. Transmission risk to people outside the class but in the same grade is then lower, and much lower to the overall school population. Stratification by the different household sizes. Well, this is comparable with what we get from other household studies. You can also impute things about how susceptibility of infection depended on age. Even more than that, because of the very detailed data collected, we could impute generation time distributions, not just for the whole epidemic, but separately for the school and adults and children in households. And you see what you might expect to see intuitively, namely the generation time distribution for school-based transmission is truncated substantially compared within the household. Namely, sick children stay at home. So beyond day one or two, they don't have much of a transmission risk in the school setting. Rather important for getting a real insight into the dynamics, and also important for intervention measures. And beyond that, you even get some insight into the relevance of actually detailed network structure. And I'm only even showing a subset of results here. In particular, students are four times more likely to play with students of the same gender. That was the social networking data. And we see that reflected in the transmission dynamics. Boys had onset before girls in this epidemic. The epidemic receded in boys. And there was evidence from the epidemic data of heterogeneous mixing between boys and girls. I'll try and finish in the next 5 or 6 minutes. Coming on to then real-time analysis more generally, that gives an example of really what you can do with very detailed data. But what are the priorities for real-time analysis? Well, I've already said most of this. I mean, I think early on, you're just wanting to characterize the nature of the new pathogen, estimate the reproduction number, the generation time, and of course, severity, which I'll come back to tomorrow in terms of the challenges there, age effects. And the branching process models are the first point of call. And only then do you start considering whether putting in full transmission models, probably at fairly simple or intermediate levels of complexity. I don't think very complex simulation models are useful tools, and particularly at the level of, say, the EpiSims type simulation, but really the only simulation models which are useful are those which can really don't require too much data to validate. So if they only include assumptions about maybe households and schools, that may be adequate. But if you start including lots more structure, then it's difficult to justify using those models in real time. And I think what we saw both in SARS and the pandemic last year is that really most of the useful analysis was done with relatively simple tools. This has a long history, and I don't have time to go into the many examples. These are just the ones I've been involved in. And again, they all reflect this. I mean, actually, the original analysis of the BSE epidemic, the mad cow disease epidemic, was a pure back calculation model. It wasn't even a branching process model. We were just allowing for the censoring and the observation of infections caused by the mortality which occurred between when animals were infected and when they developed symptoms. The 2001 foot and mouth epidemic showed the applicability of simple epidemic models to informing decisions about disease control. And then finally, in the SARS epidemic, I think in the SARS epidemic, actually, I mean, models didn't have much influence on disease control, but they did give some important insight into what mortality was and what the transmissibility of the pathogen was, and at least explain what was happening on the ground, so-called situational awareness. And this was accentuated last year. Again, I just showed the results from my group published in the Science paper last year. I mean, early on, public health policy makers wanted to know, how bad is the epidemic, how far has it got, how fast is it spreading, and what can we do? And I think we did a reasonable job at answering at least the first three of those questions in that early analysis, which really was done within the first 2 weeks of the epidemic, I should say. Getting estimates of the origin date of the epidemic from the genetic analysis and some analysis of transmissibility. Other analysis of transmissibility at the top there from the epidemic curve seen in Mexico, and a detailed analysis of a particular outbreak in Mexico. And then finally, a first pass on severity, and I'll talk more about this yesterday, from looking at how many cases have been exported to other countries of the world. So just to conclude, and I will talk a lot more about pandemic flu tomorrow, so I'm not going to go into more details today. I've given a little overview of how I kind of see what are the most important tools for dealing with emerging infectious disease outbreaks, particularly in real time, and how they're rooted in the applied mathematics of underpinning those models. What are the outstanding issues in terms of priorities for future research? Well, one of them, as highlighted last year, is just the frailties of surveillance data and not taking it too literally. We never observe, or very rarely observe, what I refer to in the talk, namely the incidence of infected individuals. What we typically, this is at the bottom of the so-called surveillance pyramid, right at the bottom you have all those people exposed to somebody infected who may or may not have been infected themselves. These are people who might seroconvert to infection, have been infected, but may or may not show disease, they may be asymptomatic. Here are the people who may show disease, might have a, if it's flu, might have a cough or a cold or something, or fever. A subset of those will seek medical attention. This is what we pick up in surveillance systems. For influenza-like illness, and then right at the top, a very small subset of those, all those people infected, will actually be virologically tested, and with lab-based surveillance, and you have a confirmed case. The reason I show this is that not allowing for the vagaries and the delays in this pyramid, in analysing data, particularly data collected right at the top of the pyramid, can lead to making rather naive and inaccurate judgments about what is going on. And I think last year, all of us treated the confirmed case data from multiple countries a little too literally as reflecting what was really going on in populations, a point I'll return to tomorrow. I've laboured this point already, so I'll skip quickly onwards. I think if you want to use models to make conclusions relevant for disease control policies, one has to examine what natural history assumptions you're using in the model, because they have a fundamental effect on both the dynamics you get out, the timescale of those dynamics, but also about things about the impact of interventions. If you have this natural history assumption, this generation time distribution, which says that infectiousness peaks 2 days after, well, basically simultaneous with symptom onset, about 1 or 2 days after infection, and declines rapidly thereafter, then if you only treat people, let's say, day 3 or 4, you're going to have a very limited impact, and you're using treatment to reduce transmission, you're going to have a very limited impact on transmission overall. Whilst a different assumption about the generation time distribution would give you a different conclusion. Of course, I've already explained why it's important for accurate imputation of the reproduction number. More generally, we would like to have a theory of transmission. I don't mean a theory of transmission between people, I mean a mechanistic, physical theory of transmission. If I sneeze now, could we model the transmission risk for a particular pathogen to people in this room? At the current time, we don't. We don't know enough about transmission mechanism, the relative role of aerosols versus droplets versus other forms of contact for respiratory diseases or indeed any disease. But if we did have that in the long term, we could do a lot better. More generally, going out from that, we would like to have more detailed data on the transmission and risk associated with particular types of contact, being in the same room, being in the same household, spending a certain amount of time with an individual at a certain stage of symptoms. A lot of effort is being put into designing studies which are starting to get at this, but really our knowledge is still in its infancy. And all of these things and many other uncertainties limit the predictability of epidemics in terms of truly saying what's going on. This is slightly out of order, done for a different talk, but spatial epidemics are a particular problem, and this is motivated by foot and mouth disease. It could equally be pandemic. Flu, of course, ahead of time, or based on the first few cases, it's very difficult to make a very deterministic prediction of what is the spatial trajectory of an epidemic. At best, you can do sort of ensemble behaviours over multiple predictions, a sort of risk map of which country is likely to be affected first or which region is most at risk. And that's largely because of these fat-tailed spatial kernels and the fact that long-range transmission is a very rare event. But more generally for emerging epidemics, there are huge parameter uncertainties. We don't know whether we've got the right model. Early on, data is very limited, and so that makes prediction more than a few weeks ahead incredibly challenging. And we may be missing some very key factors from models. I actually think that the simple assumption of a simple mass action contact rate, S times I, with whatever level of heterogeneity you put into that, is probably too much of a simplification, and almost certainly we have something rather more complex going on, perhaps involving even including dose dependency. And what that results in is there are very few examples in the literature of people making truly reliable predictions ahead of time. Finally, what makes models reliable? Let me go back up here. And I would answer, and slightly controversially, really it's who does it. And the first thing to say is that in terms of infectious disease modelling, at least in infectious disease modelling, which aims to inform public health, programming models is not the hard bit of it, neither is solving equations. The real hard bit is knowing the biology of the pathogen, knowing how to speak to public health policymakers, MDs, MPHs, and knowing what are the relevant questions to ask and how to communicate results. Of course, you need the expertise in modern methods, and I hope I've shown some of them in this lecture, but knowing how to communicate that to people who will use the output of models is the key thing. We're not gazing into a crystal ball with modeling. We can't create knowledge where there is none. We're not a substitute for data, and I think that's one of the key lessons to communicate. True validation is very difficult, no two epidemics alike, and for that reason, there's even more onus on ourselves to be as statistically rigorous as possible when we do modelling, and to any extent possible, estimate parameters from primary data. So just to sum up, I mean, this isn't really a summary of the talk, but just kind of looking forward. And clearly we live in a more mobile, more populous world than ever before, and diseases, as we saw last year, spreading faster than ever before. All the public health agencies of the world realize this means we need to respond faster than ever before. Our planning needs to be better than it's ever been. Thankfully, our data systems, our data collection systems, are also better than they have been, and we saw that last year with the rapidity with which even very detailed data was collected and shared, at least within a limited subset of groups. And analysis and modelling, applied mathematics, has been shown to be a powerful tool to assist in public health policy making in contingencies. It isn't a panacea, but I think even the most cynical of public health policymakers are starting to concede that we have a role there somewhere, even though sometimes the role has been exaggerated in past epidemics. It's useful in contingency planning. I'll show this tomorrow. In characterising new threats, again, I'll try and highlight this tomorrow again. One thing I won't have time to go into, but I think many of you are involved in, it's useful for informing study design, surveillance system design, and of course assessing control policy options. And what I've highlighted today, it's important in the characterization of new threats and giving situational awareness to policymakers in epidemics. And my key take-home message, and what I hope I've conveyed to you today, is my view is that the best modeling has to be rooted in the data, biological, epidemiological, and clinical data. Modelling in the absence of data is really an intellectual exercise, which may be of interest and may have some validity in its own right, but is not relevant for public health, informing public health planning. Thank you. And apologies for eating into the reception time.